It's Tuesday, March 19th, 2024, from Peach Fish Productions. It's The Gist. I'm Mike Pesca. And we are here in day two of Crime Week. Now, Crime Week, we talked to Jeff Asher yesterday about the trends in murder and other crime in the United States. Now we're going to pivot and talk not about international crime, like, say, thievery rates in Belgium. We're going to talk about war crimes. We're going to talk about genocide, and we're definitely going to talk about proportionality, specifically about the war in Gaza. And joining me is Ken Anderson, who's a professor of law at Washington College of Law at American University and a visiting fellow at the Hoover Institution of War, Revolution, and Peace at Stanford University. He has excellent credentials because he has worked, as you will hear in this conversation, with all the big human rights organizations and those that document and try to ascertain if war crimes were committed, if crimes against humanity were committed, definitions like proportionality and genocide. He looks at it from a real lawyer's perspective, and that's part of his critique. He thinks that since the humanitarian field has gotten ascendant in the field of war crimes, overall, there have been costs to the field, namely that the human rights advocates, well, we'll let him say it, but there is the general sense that they, when they look at the concept of war crimes, they generally believe that war is a crime. But from there, it's very hard to pursue the actual legitimate aims of war if you don't think that anything's legitimate. So Ken Anderson is the kind of person who talks to JAG lawyers. He talks to people who work at the International Court. He has worked in all these organizations. He has written some of the most influential books on the issue of war crimes. We're going to focus a lot on what the Israel military has been doing in Gaza, if that's proportionality, if anything is proportionality, and where he thinks the field of humanitarian law is going. Kenneth Anderson for the whole show up next. A lot of times when you hear about VPNs, I find that they just assume you know what they are, or even if you have an understanding, oh, they're a virtual private network, you might not know the acronym, but in general, don't they mask what you do online? Why do I need that? People don't explain it correctly, and it was explained to me when I got into the beneficial aspects of Surfshark. So a VPN does mask what you do online, and that's really important for some people who, might be trying to be a dissident in an oppressive regime. It's also just important in terms of general hygiene for why do you have to let every advertiser and everyone else know where you were and, you know, follow your tracks. But I find it's also very practical. Like I said, it's a mask. And so a mask does hide identity, but a mask, a well-fitted N95 mask, also might protect you, which is what a VPN does too. Practically, however, in my life, there are many websites that when I'm traveling, I can access. I have and pay for access to them. Then I find myself in as far-flung a place as Canada. Sometimes, as an American, a foreign version of, say, Netflix would come in handy. I'd like to watch some of those shows, and I'm not just talking about Czechoslovak soap operas. I'm talking about how the excellent movies move in and out of the different Netflix in different localities. With a really good VPN like Surfshark, you could access all of them. And another big one for me is there is a major broadcaster in Britain. It is a broadcasting company there, but they don't let me hear all the stuff that someone there can hear. With a VPN, I could listen to that as if I were there. There are so many practical uses, plus the traditional use of why let them know exactly what you're doing. Your surfing is for you. A VPN allows you to surf what you want to surf, where you want to surf, without interference from, let's say, repressive governments or the Czech Netflix regime. Get Surfshark VPN at surfshark.deals/gist. What are those deals? Well, enter promo code GIST for 3 extra months for free. You heard me right. 3 extra months for free. That's surfshark.deals/gist. This episode is brought to you by the Jordan Harbinger Show. You've heard me talk about the Jordan Harbinger Show because it's one of my favorites. He does in-depth interviews with some of the world's most fascinating minds. I can name a few: Barbara Boxer, Anderson Cooper, Michael McFaul, the Ukraine or Russia ambassador talking about Ukraine. One I recently listened to was Stanley McChrystal, the general, the former general, and he told an interesting story about revering Robert E. Lee. But then, after having a portrait of him for 40 years, he's a 63-year-old man, throwing it in the trash. Because his wife says, you know, what that picture and that man means to you, it doesn't mean to other people, and you have to understand that. And then in the interview, they got around to the point where McChrystal talked about that interview in Rolling Stone magazine that pretty much ended his career, where got to the desk of Barack Obama, and it had McChrystal saying unflattering things about the war effort, and just how he talked to his wife and how they decided not to be bitter and not to wallow in it. He could have taken some shots at the process, the reporter, or the president at that point, but he didn't. It was just an overall good interview. It was facilitated by Jordan's excellent interview style. Whether Jordan is conducting an interview or giving advice to a listener, you will find something useful that can apply to your own life in every single episode of the Jordan Harbinger Show. That could mean learning how to ask for advice the right way or discovering a little mindset tweak that changes how you see the world. Search for the Jordan Harbinger Show. That's H-A-R, like the first three letters in hard, B-I-N-G-E, as in how you'll want to catch up on all the episodes on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. For many months, we've been circling issues of international war, sometimes I think kind of assuming that this term has an agreed upon definition. Well, one of the deepest and best thinkers on all of these issues is Kenneth Anderson. He's a professor at Washington College of Law at American University, and so many credits, but let's list a couple. Fellow at the Hoover Institution, non-resident fellow at Brookings. He once served as head of Human Rights Watch's Arms Division and became general counsel of the Open Society Institute. He writes on international law and the war of law. We're going to talk to him about all of this. Ken Anderson, welcome to The Gist.
Absolutely delighted to be here.
So let's start with a super easy question. When we talk about international law and we or the West assumes that it is a thing and it has legitimacy and the International Court of Justice doesn't have power or influence simply because they have nice robes, how solid is that idea really?
The International Court of Justice, now I want to distinguish at the outset from the International Court of Justice, which has been around actually quite a long time, and the sort of classic things you would associate over the historical run of the International Court of Justice would be settling boundaries between states, for example, waterways, things like that, in which in an earlier time you might have taken these things and asked the Pope to arbitrate, right? But we then get this International Court of Justice. And so that I want to sharply distinguish, because it's in the news today in ways that it normally is not, from the International Criminal Court, the ICC, which is a creation of human rights and political movements and all that stuff during the 1990s. And the court has jurisdiction over war crimes and, you know, that kind of extremely serious stuff. But the International Court of Justice is what we're seeing under discussion now, because it has been hearing a complaint by South Africa in order to essentially bring pressure on Israel. There may be a role at some point for the International Criminal Court, hard to say at this point, but these are courts which these days have status under the United Nations system as institutions with a lot of autonomy, certainly, but they fall under the kind of international organization's umbrella. And what's their legitimacy? A lot of states have, you know, agreed to their jurisdiction and agreed to the statutes and treaties and the rest that have created them. How effective have they been? Generally speaking, the less important the issue, the more effective they've been. In other words, because, and I don't mean that flippantly, I mean that in the sense that the truly serious issues that are of existential importance to important parties will never wind up being things that can be settled by institutions of that kind.
Right. So they've had a few genocide cases before them. And from what I understand, they've never actually issued an adjudication that decreed, yes, that was a genocide. They, in one case, faulted a nation state for not stopping a genocide. But it does seem to me that what you said early on, that it's sometimes useful just to have an answer, no matter what the answer is. That is not true with these genocide cases and other very important cases. And so I asked for your analysis if the institution of the International Court of Justice is the right one to actually settle this case or allegation of genocide if the participants reject that adjudication.
I think genocide is a particular problem from the standpoint of law, because the term has drifted to be used so widely in ways that have very little to do with its kind of original formulation after the Second World War, after Nuremberg, with the treaty that kind of defines it in these various ways, an intent to destroy a group described in various ways in whole or in part. Those things are all very constraining and hard to figure out exactly what they mean. But the truth is that what we're primarily concerned about in international politics, and I think should be in international law, very rarely is actually genocide in the formal legal sense. Most of the time what we are concerned about is what the International Criminal Court correctly, I think, treats as being mass atrocity crimes under the name of crimes against humanity, which doesn't require any special animus toward a group or racial or some kind of thing like that.
And tell me if I'm right, it doesn't have that mens rea component. It doesn't need to prove intent that these.
Correct.
So then, would you said something, you said many things interesting, but there was an interesting thing you said I want to talk about, which is that the definition has shifted, and it has the definition as used in common or even maybe specified parlance. But the written definition, the definition that the judges on the ICJ are looking at, hasn't shifted. So therefore, in order to maintain legitimacy, does it have to, do you think, it has to look at what the definition is and what the facts are and say that definition does not apply to the facts, that would further its legitimacy? Or, as many in the international community says, the legitimacy depends on recognizing that there is plainly a genocide going on in Gaza.
I think that from the standpoint of the legitimacy of the court and the legitimacy of whatever it says about this, the International Court of Justice in particular would do well to wind up, I would say, explicitly avoiding the genocide claim in favor of saying whatever it might want to say about the facts, which I would probably disagree with how they would characterize them, but to focus on a result that you think is substantively the right result without having to try and interpret the meaning of something as difficult and impenetrable and frankly, these days, completely subjective. I mean, the definitions of genocide, cultural genocide, getting tossed around by geographers and sociologists and you know, kind of all these different sort of humanities and social science areas, it doesn't mean anything anymore. I mean, right. It just doesn't. And so I think that's an unfortunate consequence of having something where it's regarded as sort of the ultimate crime. So everybody wants to grab onto it for their particular thing. And at the same time, a very narrow needle to thread.
I want to ask you two implications of that. So first of all, I ask you in the Gaza context, would you apply what you just said to other cases before this tribunal that are alleging genocide, the Uyghurs, the Ukrainians, in general, avoid deciding that something is genocide? as a general rule, are you more saying that the facts of the case against Israel adhere to that rule?
I would prefer that all of these cases wind up skipping the genocide thing. The Uyghurs might be an exception, but mm-hmm. Things like Ukraine and those things. But in general, I'll sort of soften that slightly and say, I just think that the use of the term genocide at this point is so completely, on the one hand, overstated, but on the other hand, completely diluted to mean whatever it is you want it to mean. And that the far better approach at this point is, frankly, the one that the International Criminal Court has tended to prefer, which is to instead focus on the actions and to say, does this constitute crimes against humanity without any requirements? You know, in other words, the intent would be the same kind of intent as murder. You know, these kind of standards that don't require any of the special features of genocide, but also lower the temperature ever so slightly, political temperature ever so slightly, because they aren't sort of invoking the worst crime in the whole canon. Hmm. So I would prefer to see that myself, because I just I don't think that it gets to anything that is functionally useful in attempting to persuade parties on all sides in this and many other conflicts to take account of how can you minimize the harm to civilians in armed conflict.
Are the forces on that side of the fence, as you phrased it, looking for something functionally useful, or looking for a device to shame their opponent?
Look, I mean, this is just me speaking, and lots of people disagree, but my view of this is that this was entirely a lawfare-generated strategy in which the purpose and the function of this was to deliberately risk their own civilian population in order to put all sorts of political pressure on the Israelis not to respond in the ways they might otherwise have done so. And I think, you know, there's a lot of talk about human shields and using the population as human shields. And I take very much a point made by Professor Matthew Waxman at Columbia Law School that human shields isn't really quite an adequate description of what the civilian population is being used for. I mean, it's not exactly like Saddam putting a bunch of diplomats on a bridge in order to try and, you know, I mean, 20, 30 people stuck on a bridge, so it makes it hard to decide to bomb it. You're talking about the whole of the civilian population in one of the most densely populated places on Earth, where everything about the placement of the tunnels, the placement, you know, all of those things wind up being a sort of invitation to say, are you really going to come and engage in war against us? Yeah. Think of it as being, if the diplomats on the bridge are sort of a tactical example of this, then this is the strategic example of the entire population is sort of gambled upon.
It's more like parasite or host or a cancer within a body, and to kill the cancer, you have to risk the entire organism. So when it comes to those, just like you said, that's your opinion, that what I just said is my opinion. So let us talk about if Israel does come before a tribunal like the International Criminal Court, if war crimes are alleged, there is the issue, there could be a few issues, but one is the issue of proportionality, which is the, under the law, you can't, there are acceptable times when civilians can be killed. There are unacceptable times, but it seems very hazy to me, but you're the expert. How strict a or how useful a definition of proportionality is there such that we can apply it to what's going on in Gaza?
Okay. So the rule about proportion, the rules in a sort of loose sense of the law of war regarding, or the law of armed conflict regarding these things, that's independent of anything in the courts. It's independent of anything in the ICC. That is, militaries have to formulate operational doctrines to be able to carry out their operations in a way which is consistent with their legal obligations under the law of armed conflict. But parties accept most of the time that they have got a legal obligation to comply with that, irrespective of whether anything might be in front of a court or something. And the lawyers would call this the operational law of war, because the rules themselves, as they're formulated in international law, wind up being necessarily very general because they apply to all forms of armed conflict. And the question of how you can bring these things down to specific cases involves a lot of judgments where the legal standard is one of reasonableness in the circumstances. And so the rule of proportionality is, under what circumstances is it okay to risk civilian life? And the answer is, you are entitled to attack the enemy. Right. And there are rules in place that talk about precautions to be taken in attack. And they are, again, a sort of rule of reasonableness, because you are not deprived of the opportunity to take the fight to the enemy. And in doing so, you're going to wind up risking civilians. And we have these rules that regarding acceptable and unacceptable collateral damage, precautions that you have to take in all forms of military operations to try and minimize. But at the end of the day, you're not deprived of the opportunity to attack the enemy. And the problem that arises is when you have a side willing to break the rules. They are not considering precautions in attack. On the other, on the contrary, they're deliberately gambling their own population in order to rely on your unwillingness to risk the civilian population. Mm-hmm. So the Israelis are being told, you can't do this, you can't do that, you can't do that. But they're allowed to do all these things. And even if we grant that they're illegal, you still have to obey the law, and that means that you have to make up for their violations of law on the other side. And that's what a lot of folks are saying out there, and it is legally not correct. The legal rule, I guess I would describe it as a law of war lawyer, would be, yes, you are required to take as many precautions in attack as you can reasonably do consistent with military necessity. But at the same time, we have to recognize that if that other side over there is deliberately violating the laws of war and putting their own civilian population at risk in order to make it harder for you to attack, you are not deprived of the ability to make that attack. And it is not your fault. And it's not your legal responsibility when it inevitably results in higher civilian casualties than might otherwise have been the case had both sides followed the law.
And we'll be back in a moment with more of Ken Anderson. We're talking with Ken Anderson, professor of law at Washington College of Law at American University. Let us rejoin the conversation. So the enemy's actions can expand the acceptable reactions of the fighting force, but not exponentially or not infinitely. There mm-hmm. are still limits. So there are issues of munitions, 2,000-pound bombs dropped on the Jabila refugee camp to kill, Israel says, let's take them at their word, a few high-profile military commanders. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to ask you to be the judge and just say, you know, violation or not violation, but what would be the considerations to take into account to see if that counts as proportional?
It's a balancing of military necessity. What's the nature of the targets you're going after? And it's not, I mean, the one thing that it's not is simply saying number of civilian lives versus number of combatants on either side.
Or size of the munition, size of the crater, number of dead enemies. But so if you were prosecuting that case, that Israel in an instance did commit a war crime, granted, proportional is a term of art, and it has a vague definition, as does cruel and unusual in the United States context, as does reasonable use of force. But we have doctrine that defines what reasonable use of force is. So how would you, as a prosecutor against Israel, what would be the factors that you think you would point to that you could get a quote-unquote conviction for international in the International Criminal Court for an act like that?
I mean, I guess the things that I would wind up looking at would be, in the first place, did they go through a process of trying to establish what they think the civilian harm was going to be? They're not required to be infallible, right, about those kind of guesses and all that stuff. So in the first place, I'd be looking to the process that was followed. And if you wind up seeing something that looks like it was just arbitrary and out of the blue and not justified by the timing that was required, instant decision had to be made. Those are the kinds of factors that I would look for if I were a prosecutor. So I'd start with the process.
But doesn't that allow for the possibility that an advanced military such as the United States or Israel, which does have processes and lawyers, and then comes to the decision, the kill decision, are you creating circular reasoning or something tautological? Every time we issue the kill decision, it is a right decision because we underwent the process that determined what was a right decision.
Yes, that is always a possibility, not just in this stuff, right? I mean,
That's right. Think about Derek Chauvin. Think about how did we decide if he was guilty? We went through what the process of the Minneapolis police was to use in such a setting. We found violations of that process. So yeah, you're right. There is an analogy, but how do you say get a conviction despite the very advanced military saying, well, we went through the process and the process is never wrong, or at least will always indemnify us under these rules we're talking about?
I think that this is what the critics said to the United States about the sort of process of accumulating intelligence to decide to take drone strikes in various places. At the same time, the military necessity doesn't go away. And would you rather have a process which you can look at any particular case and say, you guys did not go through the process in good faith? This was just, and there is a subjective and kind of good faith element to that that I don't think can ever be eliminated. And the standards also have to be permitted to evolve as one discovers, usually in the circumstances of a particular conflict, things that you don't necessarily need to do in order to achieve your military aim. So technology advances and you've got better targeting or more precision or things like that. I think that one of the issues that's out there now, and this is not about Gaza, but is actually about Ukraine, is that we have, in the kind of the Western democracies, loosely meaning kind of everybody who's not the bad guys, have kind of accepted an obligation to go forward with technology improving precision of weapons, then enabling more discrete operations and, it's kind of that process. One of the things that Ukraine teaches us is that Russia doesn't really care, right? I mean, Putin doesn't care. But in a weird way, I've sometimes wondered, I've had conversations sometimes over the past 15 years with Russian diplomats where I had the strong impression that they thought that the kind of rising legal standards of reasonableness, which the U.S. has been strongly pushing for a long time without ever going into sort of crazy idealism that means you can't fight a war, that stuff the Russians kind of felt like was imposed on them during the 1990s when they were very weak and they had no ability to say no to the West, but they never actually bought into this. And
do you think Israel's in that group, that they weren't consulted on these advancements of precision targeting?
No, I think Israel has been at the forefront of all this. I mean,
I know.
It's not like the U.S., where it can at least imagine to itself that it's going to decisively defeat the enemy that's halfway around the world. If you're Israel, your ability to manage your security in some way where you can't make the neighborhood go away is going to depend on your ability to develop better and better precision and better target identification and surveillance and intelligence capabilities in the technical areas. And at the same time, have a doctrine which is generally speaking going to favor great restraint, because you don't want to wind up setting off a war. And then when the other side decides to set off a war, which is what they did, and it spent, you know, many years, of course, planning for it, then you're still going to wind up wanting to sort of take account of what happens the morning after this thing is over, as a lot of people have sort of expressed it.
I heard an interview with Ken Roth, who is the head, longtime head of Human Rights Watch, where you used to work. And he was asked, so what would be acceptable targeting of Hamas by Israel? And he pretty much refused to answer, but then eventually said, if identified Hamas commanders who were involved in October 7th were in a structure in a field with no civilians around them and were armed, Israel would probably be justified in engaging in an attack. So here's the question. Should we not ask, like, we just shouldn't, just as one might not ask a defense attorney, oh, what's the best way for the police to shoot someone who's armed? I don't know. There's some school of thought that says that's not the defense attorney's job to articulate. The other one says, actually tell us how to do the job so that your criticisms bear more weight. I mean, what do you think of that answer? I guess you laughed. Look,
I laugh, you know, because look, and by the way, Ken has actually stepped down as the head of Human Rights Watch, and you know, and I like Ken, right? I mean, but so this isn't personal, but it's just nonsense, right? I mean, named off a series of conditions that can effectively never be met, and knows they can't be met, and is serious about them only because he doesn't expect them to be met. And does Ken Roth or the lawyers at Human Rights Watch believe that this is a reasonable answer under the existing law of war? I can't imagine that they do, but they maintain the sort of outward face that this is what it all requires. And it's actually a disengagement from the conversation with the law that actually matters. And I think that they have to understand that it can't really be the answer. And in a certain sense, it goes back to the question of whether you believe that there is ever a right side and a wrong side, or whether you believe that you're entitled to fight for your side, even if you're Hamas, and that you are entitled to be able to fight within a certain boundaries of the law, and that part of the point of the law of war is to not wind up judging which side is the right side and which side is the wrong side, not when it comes to military operations, to the actual conduct of fighting. We'll sort of suspend disbelief about that and say, if both sides fight according to the law, then we're not going to hold, I mean, it's a separate question of who we hold accountable for having, you know, started the thing rightly or wrongly. You know, Human Rights Watch has become relentlessly results oriented, in the sense we'd use that in American law to say it's just, you know, results oriented jurisprudence. And there are many places in the world where Human Rights Watch does a magnificent and necessary job. Any place in the Middle East is not one of them.
Yeah. And so finally, during your time doing what you've done, as there have been advances in technology, in targeting, in the conception of human rights, but also what you're talking about, the international rights community has gained a lot more influence. I don't want to ask if the number of war crimes or crimes against humanity or war atrocities have increased or decreased, because that's not a fair question. You have to look, you have to judge it against the number of conflicts, and that's always going to influence how many people, you know, suffer from war crimes. But is the likelihood of combatants committing a war crime, do you think that that has decreased because of the efforts of the entire apparatus that you've been invested in and that we've been talking about?
Yeah, I actually do. And I think that is partly the result of technological capabilities of being able to capture closer to in real-time operation. You're not left trying to go in years after the fact in order to, you know, dig up graves. And I've been involved in investigations in northern Iraq, for example, and that kind of forensic stuff. But the ability to sort of capture a lot of this in real time and be able to see what's going on, I think, does wind up putting a certain concern into the hearts of people that might otherwise just kind of blow off the rules if they're ever committed to them in the first place. At the same time, it can also threaten to put fear into the hearts of the people that are trying to observe the rules. And that always winds up eventually running the risk that somebody says, I just don't think the rules mean very much, so we're going to do whatever we feel like. I think that the fundamental issue is trying to get the humanitarian and human rights organizations back to a dialogue with the actual law of war as it actually makes some difference to the actors that actually care about it. And I would say that my friends in the operational law community and a lot of countries' militaries, the sort of the JAG level folks, they've really written off these communities as just both being results oriented in certain conflicts like Gaza. Or they're simply trying to invent an alternative law of war and tell everybody else that this is what the law of war is, and it just isn't.
Professor Kenneth Anderson teaches at the American University Washington College of Law, and he is an expert and has written extensively on issues of autonomous weapons, targeted killings, international law. Thank you so much.
Thank you. A real pleasure.
And that's it for today's show. Corey Wara produces The Gist. Joel Patterson is the senior producer. You know them as the Quaint Mallards. I know Michelle Pesca as the director of special projects for Peachfish Productions. The Gist is sponsored in collaboration with Libsyn's AdvertiseCast. For advertising inquiries, go to advertisecast.com/thegist. Thank you for listening.